Okay, and we're going to conclude today with a presentation from David Montgomery.
Great, thank you. Thank you for all coming. It's a bit dangerous to be the person standing between this many people and lunch, so I will try and get us through to that great event as soon as we can, and I have no idea what to make about the gravity amendment. It was unfortunate that it's been repealed by administrative fiat in this state. But that's not what I came here to talk about. What I wanted to talk about at the Water Center was dirt. And it's not because I intend to talk about mud, but actually, if you think about the kind of things over the next couple hundred years that are absolutely critical for us as a species to sustain in order to maintain our civilization, there are really three things. The atmosphere and climate change is, of course, one of the big challenges that we face in the upcoming century, as is challenges over the distribution and use of fresh water, as previous speakers have engaged in. But what I want to talk about is that third one that we don't really talk about all that much as a society, and that the failure to address has, in fact, brought down many ancient societies, and that's soil conservation. Why did I call the book that I'm essentially talking about dirt? Well, it was obviously to sell copies, because nobody would buy a book called Soil, the Erosion of Civilization. Yeah, and my publisher was smart enough to figure that out well before I had suggested it. But I did receive one absolutely flaming email from a soil scientist complaining about the title of the book, but the guy has no sense of humor, so I won't name him. But what I tried to do in writing this book was wrestle with what I think is a very simple question. From a geologist's perspective, what would be required to actually sustain a civilization? And if we look at where we get our food, as fond as I am of salmon and eating salmon and their history, seafood only provides about 3% of the calories in the human diet. We basically eat grains. Our food comes from the soil. 97% of our food comes from the soil. And therefore, the fundamental condition for sustaining an agricultural society is sustaining the soil itself. Sustaining soil fertility is a related issue that I go into in the book, but I'd like to talk today about the more simple issue of simply keeping dirt around. And ask the question of, can soil erosion actually limit the lifespan of civilizations? And I may be telegraphing the answer, but it's a question that I really tried to wrestle with hard in coming to grips with this history of how people, the way people treated land, in the end came to shape how the land treated their societies. And I want to share with you a little bit of the historical insight that I put into the book, but also the data that the publisher would not let me put into a popular book. I'll show all that to you today and explain why I went into it. But essentially, if you look back at the last couple decades, there's been a lot of geoarchaeological research that has shown that soil erosion played a role, whether a key role or not, we could argue about, but that's why I looked into it and wrote the book, in the demise of ancient civilizations, ranging from Bronze Age Europe to classical Greece, Rome, southern United States, Central America, society after society. I only found a couple examples of societies that actually stewarded their soil as a resource for many generations in a way that we might consider sustainable from a geological perspective. And I realize that in all the different definitions of sustainability that are floating around out there, you know, using a geological one and invoking geological time might not be fair. I mean, after all, it is essentially time is the one thing that geologists have an awful lot to play with. But I think it is, in fact, one of the limiting ways to look at how long our civilization might be around, because the sun's not due to go out for, what, another 4 billion years or something? We could have a long run at this planet if we take care of those three things, the atmosphere, the water, and the soil. If we look, though, at the historical environmental history texts, you'll often find the argument that deforestation led to the degradation of soil resources that has been invoked in the decline of past civilizations. But if you have, like I have, worked in the Oregon Coast Range for many years, it's been deforested, what, 3 or 4 times in the last century. Most of this state's been deforested several times. The rate of soil loss, as much as I might like to blame the timber industry for the demise of ancient civilizations, or how people might think that I might like to blame them, you can't do it. The numbers just don't add up. The rates of soil loss are not there, whether in the historical record or modern data, as I'll show you, to actually make the argument stick that deforestation was to blame for ancient soil erosion and soil loss. Trees just grow back too rapidly. The understory grows back rapidly. Now, there is a major increase in the rate of landsliding as a result of timber clearing, particularly on steep slopes, and I never imagined how much trouble one might get into by pointing that out in public in this state. But now I know. But in terms of, you know, catastrophic wholesale loss of the soil, deforestation just doesn't add up. The numbers aren't there. There is, though, a tool, you know, not the chainsaw, but the plow, that actually is one where the numbers do, in fact, add up, and I think the historical record backs it up. Because the invention of the plow, those many thousands of years ago, fundamentally altered the balance between soil production and soil erosion. And if you want a one-sentence summary of what my book, Dirt, is about, it's about how the plow reshaped the nature of the surface of the earth as people used it to essentially farm conventionally, and how the long-term slow loss of soil that resulted from that essentially literally pulled the rug, pulled the foundation, the natural capital, out from under society after society, and is continuing to do so today to our modern global society. Well, so if we look at this at soil as a system, something that's produced, something that's lost, something that can be maintained, that has a store, if you will, this is essentially the kind of graph that we'd put in a geomorphic journal, which is where I stole it from one of my papers, that basically invites you to think about dirt in a way that most people don't, and that is as a system. Because under native vegetation, a typical soil thickness will develop that reflects the local climate, vegetation, topography, and geology. Those four things, including then time, the time it takes for things to develop, are what constitutes Hans Jenny's sort of famous factors of soil formation from the 1940s. You know, they affect the rate that soil is formed and the character of those soils. Those are also the factors, though, that affect rates of soil erosion. Same kind of factors. And if you let the system run long enough on a natural hillside, and I'm not talking about floodplains, I can deal with those in questions if you want later, they occupy a small part of the landscape, they're great agricultural land, and very little of what I'm talking about today actually pertains to floodplains. But on hill slopes, they tend to evolve into a state where you get a relatively constant natural thickness of soil that would be there if you came back every few thousand years over geologic time. There could be lots of erosion going on, but the soil thickness, the store of soil on the hillside, would be roughly the same because of this balance that develops between all these factors that influence soil production and soil erosion. Well, if you take that simple view of a soil, essentially to heart, and you think about it much like you might think about your bank account, where there's income, there's expenses, and there's money in the bank, well, soils on hillsides are our natural capital. It's our money in the bank, if you will, agriculturally. So over time, if we take that perspective, the change in soil thickness that will result on a landscape equals the net difference between soil production and soil loss. Again, very simple system. Input minus output equals change in storage. No mysteries there. This has been recognized for a long time in terms of what it means for how the plow fundamentally reshaped agricultural soils. Nathaniel Southgate Shaler, a Harvard professor back in the 19th century, wrote that in its primitive state, the soil each year is losing a portion of its nutrient material, but the rate at which substances go away is generally not more rapid than the downward movement of the layer into bedrock. But when tillage is introduced, the inevitable tendency of the process is to increase the rate at which the soil is removed until the destruction begins to trench upon its depth and fertility. Basically, what he's saying is that on natural hillsides, you get a balance between soil production and soil erosion, much like that last sort of graph showed, or argued at least. But that when you start plowing the ground surface, the ground is left bare and vulnerable to wind and rain for some portion of the year. The rate at which it's eroded can outstrip the rate at which it's produced. And if that goes on for long enough, and you'll recall I invoke geologic time in my definition of sustainability, anything that's being lost faster than it's made will, in fact, run out. The question is when, and that means that we need to know how fast it's being lost. If you look at the data like I have and that I'll show you in a minute, you can basically demonstrate that conventional plow-based agriculture, viewed broadly and globally, has increased soil erosion by more than an order of magnitude, more than tenfold. An order of magnitude to two are probably a good range of numbers, 10 to 100 times. And this ranges from things back with the oldest image of a plow off an ancient Sumerian cylinder sealed in the upper right. It's about 4,000 years old or so, right through Egypt and the Middle Ages and then the Renaissance. The basic technology of the plow hasn't changed all that much, society after society for thousands of years in what we call conventional agriculture. Now, there's certain practices, such as plowing roughly 45-degree hillsides, that I probably don't have to convince you might not be sustainable. And you could fairly ask yourself, why would anybody, plow a hillside like this? But this guy's got his family trailing behind him. I like to show it because it both illustrates how ridiculous it is to think you could keep the soil on a hill like this by plowing it, and also how strongly the incentives may be to do something that's not sustainable when you're really trying to feed your family this year. There are real economic reasons and social reasons why farmers may adopt practices that are not sustainable to a geologist, and I'm not trying to criticize farmers either in this book or in this talk. What I'm trying to do is argue that we need to reconceive the most fundamental act of agriculture. We need to abandon our plows. I'm not saying we should turn them into swords, but you know, others have done that far too much for my taste in the last century anyway, but we do need to reconceive. Similarly, though, people have adapted to the reality of conserving soils. And the way people farm, the reason I like to show this image, is that people can adapt to the problem of soil loss. This shows some French folks back in the 19... I think it was just before the Second World War. It was published in the 50s after the war, but a photo taken before, where you see people down at the bottom end of a hillside farm in France, where they're essentially loading all the soil that was in their lowermost furrow back into a cart to, yes, truck it back to the top of their fields, dump it in the top furrow, and they've basically, there were peasants in Europe for many years, recognize that they're out of business if they lose their topsoil, so they set up a system to cart it back to the top, and they essentially have a conveyor belt where they recycle their soils year after year. That could work. The point here being is that people can adapt to things, that adapt their agricultural practices to try and conserve the soil. And I don't have time today to go into a lot of detail about that, but I did want to make that point. What I want to spend the rest of my time sharing with you, though, is that in compiling this book, I actually I did that thing that is really has become very unpopular among some academics, which is I went to the library. I actually gathered data from work other people had done that was sitting in this wonderful library we have on campus that is not accessible by Google, whatever. And I basically spent literally 3 weeks in the library getting every paper I could to compile long-term rates of geological erosion, because if you'll recall, if the rates of soil production and rates of soil erosion are in balance, then if we look at sort of very long-term rates of erosion, we're actually also looking at long-term rates of soil production. So I compiled all the geological data that I could. Why? Well, I'm a geologist. I like doing that. But I also wanted to compare it with modern agricultural erosion rates, in particular erosion rates from conventional agriculture, plow-based agriculture, that is, and also so-called alternative forms of agriculture. Well, this is the data from that. And it's basically what Alan Gillespie calls a Caltech plot because it only has one axis, and that apparently is enough to keep them busy down there. A couple slides more on, I'll show you a two-axis plot. That would be a UW plot. But basically, there's 1,400 and some odd data points on here. And the way you read it is across the x-axis, it's just erosion rates. And it shows you that there's maybe 8 orders of magnitude of erosion rates on this planet. Erosion is incredibly variable, and where you are matters. What I've done is stratified the data that I found into 4 different types. Data from the white data points are all long-term geologic erosion rates from 3 different kinds of environments. Cratons, what are cratons? Those are like the low-gradient old parts of continents. So it's like South America, the American Midwest, Africa. Think gentle slopes. Soil mantled terrain, sort of on that middle line. Those are areas like the Oregon Coast Range, the Willapa Hills, yes, Stillman Creek, I need to put a new dot on here, and sort of gentle to reasonably steep soil mantled terrain. And the alpine glaciated areas, those are real upland, steep, rocky landscapes, the Cascades, the Himalaya, the Andes, real mountain ranges. What I'd invite you to look at is that, well, within each of those different kinds of geological context, there's a several order of magnitude range of erosion rates that reflects all those other factors, the slope, the climate, the geology, yada, yada, yada. But the thing that really stands out are those black data points, that fourth category I haven't told you about yet. Those are all the data I could compile from areas that are where there's data from modern agricultural practices that were plow-based, conventional plow-based agriculture. And you'll notice, well, I'll talk about that in a moment. I want to advertise the two caveats. I did not use any data that involves sediment yield in this compilation. Why? Well, if you measure the sediment yield downstream somewhere from where you're actually interested in the erosion, there could be all kinds of stores or sinks or sources in between. I didn't want to deal with that. And I also did not use any universal soil loss equation, that USLE-based studies. Why? Well, because that equation as often wildly overpredicts erosion rates as it wildly underpredicts erosion rates, and I just made the rule, I want real data, real measurements, no models, sorry. And so basically that's the kind of data that's on here. What can we make of that data? Well, there's several points I think we can make straight off with this great one-dimensional plot, and that is that the USDA soil loss tolerance values, which range from 0.4 to 1 millimeter a year and are shown as that range on that red bar over on the right of the figure, that's the range of values the USDA defines as sustainable in modern agricultural practices. And I will submit to you that if you buy my argument that we do not tend to locate our farms in the Himalayas and the Cascades and other high mountain ranges, then that red bar is to the far right-hand side at the high erosion rate range of any kind of long-term erosion rate and therefore soil production rate you could care to show based on data. Because that 0.4 to 1 millimeter a year is sort of right over at the right-hand side of soil-mantled terrain. And so I think we can make basically two very simple conclusions off this exercise of going to the library to try and defend the argument that I was making qualitatively in the book. And that is that we've managed to turn farms into systems that erode like alpine topography. Quite literally, the American Midwest and most of our sort of conventionally farming environments are losing soils at the rate at which soil is produced and lost in things like the Himalaya. And secondly, conventional agriculture is unsustainable in soil-mantled landscapes, despite what the USDA may say about acceptable soil loss tolerance values. The position of that red line relative to those two lower sets of data demonstrates the point. Enough said. Now, on to the UW plot, because I've cleverly added a second axis, and that is it's a percentile. It's just a distribution function of all those same data that I showed in the last slide with a few other data sources added in. On the y-axis this time are the erosion rates and the percentile plot across the middle. It's a distribution function. So the 50th percentile, the median, is sort of in the middle, low values on the left, high values on the right. And what I've done is added different kinds of data. Call your attention, first of all, to those two black lines. The black line that is sort of sitting sort of high and above all the others, that's the data from conventional agriculture. It's same data as on the last plot. The lower black line is the distribution that combines the data from the cratons, the soil mantle landscape, and the alpine terrain. It's all the geological long-term erosion rate data I could find on this planet. What those three white distributions are, though, are three different kinds of data. The circles, the one shown, the circles, you can read the legend yourself, are for rates of soil production. There have been many independent studies in the last two decades that have documented how fast soils are actually produced, and all the data I could find went into that distribution. There's also data on erosion rates under native vegetation. That's the little triangles. And then also data under conservation agriculture practices. This would include both no-till agriculture and terrace-based agriculture. If you took a hillside and turned it into sort of little constructed risers and flat bits, that can cut erosion down because your effective slope goes down to about zero. The long-term problem with terracing, of course, is maintaining them, but that's a different issue. The point that I want to make on this graph is, you know, play the game of which of these things does not look like the others. It's the modern conventional agriculture. The point that I want to make strongly, though, is that we can show that agricultural practices like no-till agriculture can bring soil loss rates down to close to soil production rates. We don't have to lose soil because we farm. We've been losing soil in ancient civilizations and in the modern world because of the way that we farm. And hopefully you're sitting out there going, oh, well, distribution functions, you know, those are, you know, you can hide a lot within there. What you really want to see is data from fields where people actually had erosion rates under native vegetation and then converted it to conventional farming and measured erosion rates again. The box and whiskers plot on the left shows the human increase factor, the magnitude of the proportionate increase from the 42 odd studies I found where people had direct measurements on that. So same piece of ground, same climate, you know, same kind of soil, direct comparison. That's on the left. And it ranges from about, you know, 10 to 100 times for the great body of the data. It actually goes from about, you know, 2 times up to about 1,200 times if you look at the full distribution. But the flip side of that is the graph on the right, which shows the magnitude of the human decrease factor if you go from conventional farming to no-till farming in terms of the soil loss. And so it cuts soil loss by 10 to 100 fold if one goes to that kind of unconventional farming. These two things demonstrate that on the same piece of ground, converting it to conventional plow-based agriculture sends erosion rates through the roof 10 to 100 fold. Converting it back to no-till agriculture takes the erosion rates back down, commensurately to close to the long-term rates of soil production. Just in case you don't like distribution functions, I'll show you the data compilation that shows the median or the mean, whichever your favorite average is. And I'm not going to go through all the details on this table, but you know, clearly the numbers shown in red are different from the numbers shown in blue. The magnitude of the difference between all those blue numbers, I'm not going to argue to you today, is significant. There's a fair amount of error bar one ought to associate with this kind of data, and especially in thinking globally. But if we look at the average rate of soil loss from agricultural landscapes globally, if we say it's on the order of a millimeter a year or so, we're slightly lowballing what the actual range of data values are. So it's a conservative estimate. And if we take that and plug it into a very simple view of how long it would take to erode the soil, we can show that that one or two order of magnitude increase in soil erosion under conventional plow-based agriculture implies that erosion of a half meter to 1 meter thick soil, if it's lost at about a millimeter a year, would happen and occur in roughly about 500 to 2,000 years or so. That's approximately the lifespan of most major civilizations. And the real point that I tried to make in the book and that I want to make to you today is that if you think about what sets the rise and fall of human societies, you can think about it on two sort of scales. There's the long wavelength periodicity, which I submit to you has been greatly influenced and controlled by soil erosion, and then its productivity. It takes another 1,000 years to reform the soil once a society's plowed through it. And then there's the high frequency noise, climate change, politics, wars, social evolution, the kind of things that in the end pull the trigger on bringing a society down. They play out on this broader template. That's the point that I really wanted to make in the book. And to pass on you in an abbreviated form today, I'm not the first to make this point. Walter Loudermilk made it very well in 1953. George Perkins Marsh made it in 1864. And Plato made it in 400 BC. But using Loudermilk as the example, here in a nutshell, so to speak, we have the underlying hazard of civilization. For by clearing and cultivating sloping lands, and most of our lands are more or less sloping, we expose soils to accelerated erosion by water, by wind, and in doing this, we enter upon a regime of self-destructive agriculture. And finally, I want to close by just showing you this quote, a nation that destroys its soils destroys itself, from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who offered it in a letter to the nation's governors in 1937. That is as true today as it was when he made it. And the fundamental hazard and problem of long-term soil loss is a terribly awkward one to deal with policy-wise. I mean, Bill made the point very well, I think, of how politics can influence the non-adoption of science in policy. But there's another issue, and one that is pertinent in this case, and that is things that happen really slowly are really hard to motivate action to stem. And soil erosion, I think, has been and remains one of those key things. And so finally, I would like to thank you for coming. I note that the UW bookstore is here selling books. If you want to pick up a copy of Dirt, I'll be glad to stick around during the break. But it's great to see so many faces at the Water Center's review, and I'll be glad to answer questions, whether formally if we have time or informally if we don't, just corner me. Thank you.
Did you come across Bernard Hill's Topsoil and Civilization? The book Topsoil and Civilization?
The question is, did I come across the book Topsoil and Civilization? I read that as an undergrad. The reason I wrote this book is I read that book, and it was a very conscious attempt to update it.
Okay. Well, the question is that it seemed like that book paused enough. It was sort of a silent spring of soils, you know, when it was written. And I think the soil conservation districts and a whole lot of things came out of that, or there was a movement toward soil conservation. How successful have we been with those activities? We've spent a lot of money on that.
So the question is, how successful have we been with the soil conservation efforts that have arisen both in the aftermath of the Dust Bowl and Vernon and Carter and Dale's book on Topsoil and Civilization that was published in 1955? In many ways, we've been actually very successful. There are places where soil erosion rates, if you look at the United States nationally, in the last 20 years, we've probably cut the rate of net soil loss off agricultural fields by several fold, by two or three times, I think, are the rates that I'm familiar with. The problem is they were 10 to 100 times out. So we've made great progress, but we're still demonstrably losing soils faster than they're being made. And I can answer the question with both a pessimistic view and an optimistic view. The optimistic view is that when I was born, there was virtually no no-till agriculture in the United States. Today, too many years later for me to tell you the actual number, there's About a third of our cropland is actually farmed using no-till agriculture, nationally, about a third. So we've made great progress in adopting it. If we could actually convert the rest of it, then that would go great ways to solving the problem. But there are problems with adopting no-till that in different places for different reasons that I won't go into, that I try to go into in the book. So if you have the optimistic spin, we're actually making good progress. And as a geologist, well, if, you know, in 40-some-odd years we've solved a third of the problem, it'll only take a century to solve the rest of it. So we can all relax. If you take the pessimistic view, you could basically say the rush to essentially move to a very aggressive biofuel production over the next few years could totally undermine all the good work that's gone into soil conservation in the last 50 years. If you look at what happened to erosion in response to the wheat boom of the 1970s when Earl Butt said, you know, plant all your marginal land and sell it to the Ruskies, that actually undid a lot of soil conservation. If we do the same thing with biofuels, we'll just be setting it back. One of the reasons I wrote the book was to try and update the good work that Carter and Dale did and remind people that this is as important a problem as it is today as it was in the aftermath of the Dust Bowl. We just don't pay as much attention to it. Maybe one more question, and then, or maybe two, and then we can all have lunch. In the back.
Dave, what is the upside to the plow?
The upside to the plow is that if you take, if you imagine how many people you could feed with, on your hands and knees with a digging stick, it's not very many. If you get a bigger digging stick and you convince a cow to drag it around, you can plant a lot more area. So the basic answer is that you can feed a lot more people with the same amount of human labor. And then the cow can eat the stubble. So everybody wins. If you look at the initiation of agriculture, as far as I can tell, at least in the area that served as the origin of Western agriculture, it came as a response to people who are absolutely desperate to feed themselves during the Younger Dryas climate reversal. So agriculture began out of desperation, but then once techniques were developed, you could feed a lot more people using fewer people, which leads, to agricultural specialization, where now something like 2% of the U.S. populace are farmers, and the 98% of the rest of us who aren't out there working the fields are benefiting from that leveraging. And one of the big issues for the next century is how to balance the sort of maintaining long-term soil productivity in the face of trade-offs between mechanization and loss of soils, and then also the great productivity of labor-intensive farms, but the reality that most people in this country no longer desire to work in the agricultural environment. A long answer to your question, but it's a good question.
Cool. What's the trade-off with herbicide use as far as
The question is, what's the trade-off between herbicide use between no-till and conventional agriculture? And I'll advertise straight up that as a geologist, I'm probably out of my league in answering that question, and then I'll answer it anyway. From what I gathered in doing the background research on the book, there are conflicting opinions about whether or not herbicide and pesticide use needs to be increased with no-till practices. There's certainly a major... many farmers who go to no-till do adopt much more aggressive herbicide and pesticide practices. What I couldn't get, though, out of the literature is a feel for how general that is and how soil-specific it may be and how sort of farming technique it may be. Because if you have very labor-intensive organic no-till farms, those seem to be economically viable and they don't rely on pesticides and herbicides. So I think what you can do is if you're willing to think about no-till agriculture and organic agriculture as two completely discriminable and parallel issues, you can have no-till and organic and work very successfully, but it seems to me to be favored by labor-intensive farming setups, whereas if you have no-till that's not organic, it lends itself very well to large-scale mechanized agriculture. And again, with my caveat that I'm out of my league answering that, but you asked.
Thank you very much. Thanks.